holds for some time. I'm Mel Gertoff for the Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Mel Gertoff. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Antonia Gonzalez, Simone Perez, Shantia Hudson, and Eric Galatas. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
You're listening to Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. My guest today is University of Oregon professor and longtime activist Sarah Wald. Sarah is the author of multiple books, and as you'll hear today, she is a profound thinker on a wide variety of issues concerning the conservation and environmental justice communities. This was one of my favorite conversations that I have ever had on this show, in part because Sarah was so game to explore some really complicated terrain and points of tension with our movements. I definitely learned a lot, and I was happy to have some of my beliefs and understandings challenged. So from my view, this interview was too good to cut down to just one half-hour show, so I'm going to break it up into a two-parter. You can tune in next week to hear the second half of the interview, or you can hear the full conversation, free and ad-free, right now on the Coast Range Radio podcast feed. The show email is coastrangeradio@gmail.com. Please reach out anytime with guest ideas, feedback, your harshest criticisms, or if you're interested in helping me make the show. Professor Sarah Wald, welcome to Coast Range Radio.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
I'm so excited to talk with you today. Like we're going to get into, I got the chance to see you present at a webinar recently, and you were so thoughtful in the way that you treated the topics that I think we're going to talk a lot about today. I really appreciated that. And folks might not know, but you are a great friend of the show. You've helped helped me connect with some of our favorite guests, like Ryan Reed and Manuel Machado, a few other folks. So thank you so much for all that, and excited to talk with you today. So
thank you.
Let's kick things off. What do you teach and research at the University of Oregon, and how does that relate to your conservation and climate justice work here in the Pacific Northwest?
So I think it might be helpful to say that I have a PhD in an interdisciplinary field called American Studies, and my research is at the intersection of the environmental humanities and race and ethnic studies. As a humanities scholar, I'm really interested in the power of storytelling and the consequences of how stories are told and what stories are told. And because of the intersection of the fields that I work at, I'm interested in the ways mainstream environmental storytelling has embedded certain assumptions about the human relationship with the more than human world in ways that have often been exclusionary and or harmful. Some of these stories and their material consequences end up reproducing societal and environmental injustice. But I'm also really interested in other existing and not yet existing ways of imagining the human relationship to the more than human world. And this ability to imagine otherwise is part of what attracts me to literature and art, why I end up in an English department. And I think it holds the key to more just environmental storytelling and more just relationships in the world. At UO, I teach in the English department and the environmental studies program. And my classes focus, a lot of them, but not all of them, focus on environmental storytelling. So one of the classes I teach almost every year is a large introductory lecture course in the environmental humanities. And this is a class where we really examine layers of stories in historical context to understand their material consequences and their contemporary ramifications. Right now, I'm also teaching a graduate seminar in English that I'm really excited about called Environmental Humanities in a Moment of Danger. And we're looking at how contemporary scholarship can help us understand and respond to the current political movement. And that includes Tally Goff's Dark Laboratory, which is a book arguing the climate crisis originated in colonialism and white supremacy. It includes Jessica Hernandez's Fresh Banana Leaves, which focuses on indigenous science, and Alexander Mandrinsky's new book, Everyday Ecofascism. So you can see how those kinds of conversations with students are around this recent scholarship really relates to my larger interests and the conversation we're going to have today.
Sarah, how do you have time to be talking with me today? Seems like you have way too much going on to grace us with your presence. And you also just gave me like a lot of great book recommendations. So I'm going to maybe ask you for those once again later on, and I can put them in the podcast show notes. But I'm always looking for some good reading material. And I think that that's so interesting that you are focusing on narratives because they are so powerful. Wonder if you've got any particularly standout examples of some of the narratives that you're talking about. I know we're going to go into that a little bit later, but just kind of grounding us.
Well, I'm going to give you an example from Robin Wall Kimmerer, who I suspect many of your listeners know about her writing already. But in her in one of her books, she starts with the story of Sky Woman in Braiding Sweetgrass. And she talks in the story about going to her own environmental studies classrooms. And many of her students, they only think about the human relationship to nature in terms of humans harming the environment. She has a line in the book where she says, you know, how do we address and solve environmental issues or create more just worlds if we can't understand the generosity of geese? And this idea of a reciprocal relationship between humans and the more than human world that exists in the story that she starts with. And that's so different from the stories we often tell as faculty members in environmental studies classrooms. So I think about these stories not only in terms of novels and artwork and creative not writing, but in the way that I'm always telling a story when I'm in the classroom, and whose perspectives are in that story, whose perspectives aren't in that story, who are the winners, who are the losers, who gets included and excluded, how does that story leave us feeling in the classroom?
I love that. Thank you very much. And yeah, Robin Wall Kimmerer, such an amazing scientist, author, so many superlatives that we can talk about with her. So before we talk about some of these specific topics that I want to ask you about, I want to know more about your background. You know, how did you come into this work? And what's your background in activism? Because I know that you were an activist and organizer before becoming an academic.
Absolutely. I came to the Pacific Northwest. I came to Oregon for the first time at 17 to start college in Portland. And this was the moment of the late timber wars. And specifically, this was the moment where the salvage rider had gone through and people were fighting the salvage rider sales, which was a rider on a bill to support victims of the Oklahoma City bombings that basically got rid of all environmental laws on forests, saying, you know, we could log any tree that was dead, dying, or would be dead or dying. And so there was a lot of fights to stop these horrific old growth timber sales in the Pacific Northwest. And that's, I landed right in the middle of that. I got involved in the campaign to stop the Eagle Creek timber sales and to shift public lands management away from commercial extraction towards other values. I might have been the first paid staff member at BARC, Forest Watch Group for Mount Hood National Forest, that's still around today. And I was on and off the board for over a decade while I was in graduate school. I worked as well with the American Land Alliance and Forest Ethics and a group called Rainforest Relief. So I got really involved in public lands activism and advocacy while I was in college and after college. And this really was part of what led me into graduate school. I kept coming into all these incommensurabilities that I was seeing around race and labor and the environment. Now, this was the period of the WTO protests, and I was really shocked by how shocked everyone was by the Teamsters and Turtles together at last. Why was it hard to imagine Teamsters and Turtles together at last? And this was the moment in which there was a huge successful campaign to stop an anti-immigrant slate on the Sierra Club's national election. Why was that such a big deal? How could there be so many folks who were anti-immigrants involved in the Sierra Club? There were histories I clearly didn't know. And part of why I went to graduate school was to understand better these tensions between different social movements I found myself aligned with. And I really also wanted to learn from other social movements. I found that whenever I was going into any room at any organization in Portland, I was implicitly, if not explicitly, representing one of the environmental groups I worked with. And I really felt that leaving the Pacific Northwest would help me go to a different place where I could immerse myself in other movements, would help and make me a better advocate, activist, and organizer, along with the work I was studying in graduate school. And I certainly found that to be the case. And it was a real pleasure and privilege to get to come back to Oregon and get a job at the University of Oregon over a decade ago now.
Thank you for that. There's a lot that I didn't know about your background in that. Very, very cool. And I had totally forgotten that salvage rider, which if folks don't know, a rider is something that legislators will put in often an unrelated bill. So when they talk about a rider, that's what they're talking about. And I forgot that was to do with the Oklahoma City bombing. You know, those two things make a lot of sense combining, right? So let's jump into the thick of it. And you, in that recent webinar that I referenced earlier, one of the main themes that you were talking about was a justice-oriented response to public land attacks. So what is a justice-oriented response to public land attacks?
So I am really passionate about thinking about justice and environmental justice in public lands advocacy and management. So I want to start with, I think there's many values, but three values that I think are really key to thinking about public lands through a justice lens. One is land management or co-management at the least, and supporting tribal sovereignty when we talk about public lands. Public lands are all indigenous lands. I think of labor justice, that public lands are places of work. Latin workers are overrepresented in public lands labor, so we need to think about labor justice when we think about public lands. And I think we need to think about making sure that our public lands are managed broadly for multiple communities, that we're not trapping ourselves in a binary of white recreationists and white timber workers. When we think about public lands, there's a huge number of communities with diverse relationships to public lands in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So in a moment where public lands appear to be under kind of existential crisis from the Trump administration, how do we make sure when we are advocating for public lands or public lands values that we're not sacrificing justice values? And I think that's a real question for a lot of groups that are primarily defined around public lands rather than around justice. And I would suggest that it's really important that majority white and mainstream environmental groups stand with marginalized communities in this moment. And that means continuing to fight for migrant and immigrant rights, continuing to fight for land back and tribal sovereignty, continuing to fight for inclusion and justice and agency and management plans, to make sure that all of us in all of the work we do in the world are leading with our values. And I think it's really easy to fall into older models of communication in moments that appear to be moments of crisis. And I'm talking about language like our lands or public lands as untouched wilderness or the nation's heritage. So many groups have done so much work to get away from those forms of communication strategies. I think it's really important to encourage those groups to continue to stick with those values and those communication strategies in this moment. And that includes making sure we always think about the use of we and our. When I say we or I say our, I'm always including or excluding people based on who is part of the we and who is part of the our. And when public storytelling happens, I want to encourage everyone to be very conscious about that we and that our. So I want us to make sure. Oh, sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I apologize for interrupting. I just had to jump in there because I think that is such a, the we and our question is so rich, because So how do we say, and again, I'm saying we, how do I, right? You know, how do I, a white guy living in Western Oregon, say our public lands in a way that where folks, whether you're Latino, whether you're Black, white, queer, whether you're Native, where it's coming through that that's all encompassing. And that, you know, we talk about, I mean, obviously when anytime we're talking about heritage, that's some sticky, problematic territory. But so staying away from that, you know, how do we talk about our public lands while still acknowledging that those lands are stolen and illegitimate? So, you know, but recognizing that the current context does exist. Sorry, a couple questions.
I personally try not to. Yeah. Those are really important questions. Personally, I try not to say our public lands. I'm not perfect at it. I have decades of using that phrase. And I will admit I have gotten in front of a television camera and said that our public lands are our nation's heritage and to be protected, even though I intellectually know that's not what I want to be saying. Uh-huh. So I'm recognize that it's hard to be perfect, but I certainly try not to say our public lands. I don't think that's the right phrase for talking about indigenous lands that are managed by the federal government. I tend to say federally managed public lands. I think we can talk about how the federal government is managing stolen indigenous lands. I think we can talk about what values the federal government is bringing into land management and what it would mean to have different ways of managing federal lands, different decision-making processes, and different layers of co-management. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I tend to talk about not wanting the federal government to prioritize profit, greed, extraction at the sacrifice of ecological and cultural values and at the sacrifice of indigenous sovereignty. I just don't try to, I just try to stay away from talking about the narrative that these are our lands and they're an untouched wilderness that we need to protect because that's our nation's heritage. And I just think there's too many problematic narratives embedded in that story.
Yeah. Well, that's fascinating.
I try to tell a really different story.
Yeah. No, and I hear that. I guess I separate out when I'm thinking about trying to talk about public lands as an our thing, from things like, from concepts that of like wilderness areas as like untouched nature and, you know, nation's heritage kind of language. To me, those feel separate, but I totally hear you that they get bound up together. And, you know, is it really our land when it's illegitimate in the first place? These are thorny questions, but sorry, go ahead.
Well, I hear what you're saying, and I do think that there is a tension between this utopian desire for our public lands as this co-owned, co-managed, democratic public ideal, right? The vision of the commons as a collective place, a collective shared place that sits in tension with the way that all public lands are stolen indigenous lands.
And private lands too.
It's really, yeah, it's, yes, and private lands as well. It's really easy for me to get caught up in the vision of public lands as a kind of democratically managed, shared space that is outside of private property ownership in a way that I think isn't just to the history of those lands as indigenous lands. And that's part of why I stay away from saying our lands, even if I can find that vision personally really compelling. It has a history. I feel like I'm erasing when I fall into the America's best idea trap that is so appealing to me. And I think many people who've had relationships with public lands that are like mine.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. I was, you know, I've definitely been taken in by the America's best idea. If people don't know, if you haven't heard that, you know, there's this narrative out there talking about narratives that that national parks and or wilderness areas are like America's greatest idea, right? Which would be true if there weren't indigenous people living in the Grand Canyon when we designated it as a national park and then kicked them out, and that pattern repeated itself over and over and over again. So, you know, if it's our best idea, then we could use some better ideas, that's for sure. But actually...
Well, I want to come back to that, though, because I think there's a problem in, like, the Grand Canyon, right? Let's talk about the Grand Canyon for a second.
Yeah.
There's a way in which it's become the narrative that a lot of environmental groups continue to use, and that is politically powerful, and thus I think is part of why it's easy to fall back into that language in moments of crisis, that considers a place like the Grand Canyon as a recreational theme park when it's really sacred lands that have very particular tribes. Mm-hmm. That have that as their sacred spaces and homelands. And I think that's part of the problem of this narrative, mm-hmm. is that there becomes, it reinforces the America's best idea narrative. It reinforces this idea of public ownership by the United States nation or U.S. citizens on lands where many of us are unwelcome visitors.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. As somebody who deeply, deeply loves the Grand Canyon and so many other places that are obviously, as we discussed, stolen land, it's a very complicated love to have and complicated to know how to interact with it, how to talk about it. And I mean, that's why I'm really happy to be having you on the program today. So are there examples of people or organizations that are changing those narratives, you know, examples of narratives that you think are more positive that are out there, that are not just like what you think is the morally right language, but also gaining traction and finding success with that language?
I think a lot of groups have been doing really amazing work, especially in the aftermath of the Black Lives Matter movement the big protests in 2020. I think there's been a real racial reckoning in the environmental movement following the murder of Ahmaud Arbery, following, you know, what happened to Christian Cooper in Central Park. I think there's been a long movement to give birds bird names rather than names of white racists. I think there's a long history of pushing organizations to reconsider their names, like the Audubon Society, that have gained traction. I think there's been a move in a lot of mainstream environmental groups to address the question of indigenous land and supporting co-management, if not supporting land back. I think those are all really important conversations to be having and really important moves that organizations have made. And I really want to encourage those organizations not to back down right now, to kind of keep pushing forward instead of seeing this in a movement of retrenchment. I do think it's worth recognizing that the conversation that I see environmental groups having in the last 5-10 years is very different from the conversations I saw those groups having 20 years ago. So I do think that is important work that is happening and has been happening. And I see organizations engaging in land acknowledgments, and I see organizations moving beyond land acknowledgments and really thinking about how to stand as allies or accomplishments or accomplices, how to stand as allies or accomplices with tribal nations. There was a lot of interest, right, with the Northwest Forest Plan revision process in how can mainstream environmental groups make sure they are amplifying tribal voices and indigenous voices in the revision process. So I do think that work is absolutely happening and needs to continue happening.
Yeah, and I appreciate your perspective on that as somebody who's been in this work and in this community for a long time, that, you know, you've seen this changing. And I mean, just anecdotally, if you look at the founders of Earth First, who were, for whatever other good things they were also pretty racist folks that, you know, would have absolutely supported Trump's border wall, right? And then you look at anybody that's an Earth First type today, and we're talking a much more intersectional mindset there. So actually sticking with See, now this goes to a question I'll have later. Not even sure whether I should be saying native or tribal, but let's talk about, for lack of a knowing how to talk about it better, tribal dynamics with like the trad white environmental community. So we talked about this a little bit already, but if there's any other kind of narratives or instances you wanted to highlight about some of the history of how environmental and conservation organizations or just that ethos have been used to oppress and marginalize, well, not just Native people, but, you know, other oppressed folks, and then how we can talk about better language again.
Yes. So I want to say something about better language. Mm-hmm. The Native American Journalists Association has some great guidelines that are aimed towards the press about speaking about Native American or Indigenous or tribal nations. And I would send people to their website to look at those guidelines. But two really key points that they make that I think are really important is being tribally specific. So saying the specific tribal nation or Indigenous community that one is talking about, rather than saying Native Americans, when you really mean Shoshone, mm-hmm. or when you really mean the Potawatomi Nation. So I would really encourage being tribally specific whenever possible. Mm-hmm. And the second is to, when you're talking to someone or about somebody, ask them how they want to be identified and use that instead of assuming that there's one right way that works for everybody. Whether somebody wants to be referred to as Native American or as American Indian or as Indigenous or as First Nation, there's not a universal principle that can be applied that you should defer to what people individually want to say, how they want to describe themselves. So I'm just going to say that mm-hmm. as a language guideline that I would share from the Native American Journalists Association. In terms of the environmental conservation ethos as a way that's been used to oppress and marginalize Indigenous people and others, and I think we need to talk about what gets called fortress conservation, this idea that how you protect land and environment is keeping people out of it. Mm-hmm. And that often through a very militarized way. Yellowstone was occupied by the U.S. Army for 50 years between when it became a national park and when the National Park Service was founded, that there's a long history of national parks as places of military occupation in large part for the purposes of excluding Native peoples. You know, Yellowstone was called Fort Yellowstone by the military. So fortress conservation as this idea that we protect nature by mm-hmm. making sure it's a place that people are not, and seeing people as always having a harmful relationship to nature. There's Mark David Spence, a historian, has a book called Dispossessing the Wilderness, where he argued that national parks and national forests and wilderness areas had to be dispossessed before they could become places of wilderness. And this idea that there is this fantasy of an untouched nature at the point of colonialism, Spence makes this point that the idea that when we go to a national park in the U.S., we're seeing a place that looks like the world before Columbus came to the U.S., but that's a fantasy mm-hmm. because these places were managed by and living in relation with Indigenous peoples. And so it doesn't actually look like some untouched nature from history. It doesn't look like it would have looked like in 1492. And I think that's really important for us to remember. And as a narrative, that has been used to erase Indigenous presence in these places.
And that's all we have time for today on Coast Range Radio. Like I mentioned in the intro, I'll be airing the second half of my interview with Professor Sarah Wald next week, and we get into some big topics like ecofascism, whether the environmental movement is suffering from trade-off denial when it comes to a clean energy revolution, and a lot more. Again, that'll be on next week's episode of Coast Range Radio, or you can hear the whole conversation along with our entire archive, free and ad-free, on the Coast Range Radio podcast feed. Check out the podcast show notes for all of Sarah's great recommendations. We are an independent, volunteer-run production. If you like the show, please tell your friends about us, follow Coast Range Radio on the Instagrams, or best of all, directly share it with at least a couple people by texting the link to our podcast feed. Once again, the show email is coastrangeradio@gmail.com. Please reach out anytime. Thank you so much for listening. Let's make it through this together.
This is Daniela from STEM Champ. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
At KBOO, we accept many kinds of vehicle donations. We accept fuzzy vans.